Let me start by making a comment about the previous lecture, because I heard you were doing things about summation of series. And let me just, this has nothing to do with anything I'm going to lecture about, but you just might be amused by it, which is that you can think of a random walk as just summing a bunch of random variables. So it's summing a series. And so you could ask, like, what is the result of summing an infinite series of random walk steps? And we know what the answer is. But suppose that the step lengths decrease systematically with length. And it turns out that in one dimension, something magical happens, which is that if I have a one-dimensional random walk in which the length of the nth step is equal to lambda to the power n, and you ask, what is the probability distribution? So here is x, here is p of x, and the limit as n goes to infinity. Lambda here is less than 1. Because I want the random walk to converge. So it's certainly, the probability distribution is certainly confined to some region, which is like between minus 1 over 1 minus lambda and 1 over 1 minus lambda. So what does it look like in between? And the thing is, the answer turns out to be just unbelievably magical. And roughly speaking, what happens is that in a over most values of lambda, well, OK, let me just say this. Lambda less than 1/2, one gets a Cantor set. Because if lambda is less than 1/2, if your first step is to the right of length 1, say, so it's here, here's 1, then you'll never get back to the origin, because the sum of 1/2 plus a quarter and so on never can get back to the origin. So the support of the distribution breaks up into an infinite Cantor set. If lambda is between 1 and 1/2, then there's two possible answers, that for a countably, I can't spell, countably infinite set of points of lambda values, one gets a fractal distribution. And otherwise, one gets a smooth distribution. And in particular, the case where lambda is equal to the golden ratio, square root of 5 minus 1 over 2, the distribution is so unbelievably beautiful. I mean, you look at it, and it's just like it blows you away, because it's this self-similar thing on all scales, self-similar everywhere you look. So if you haven't heard about this, I urge you to just take a quick look, because it's just completely mind-boggling. You know, it's just one of those things that when you go into a into some museum, and you enter some room that you never knew existed, a new type of art form or a new type of, a new genre of music, and you just exposed it for the first time. I know that the first time I saw this, it just blew me away. And so I'm just recommending it to you if you like it. What is the reference for this? I'll have to think of one. Yeah. Anyway, so that had nothing to do with anything I'm talking about today, but I just thought, since I heard so much about summation of series, you might be amused by that. OK, so we're talking about spin systems. And let me just remind you of a couple of things from last time. So we had a thing called the flip rate, W of s. And the flip rate is the rate at which the spin at the ice site flips. And what I derived last time is that this is equal to 1/2 1 minus gamma over 2 si times si minus 1 plus si plus 1. So this was the flip rate. And I want to just keep this on the board for the entire lecture. Is let's just try and understand what this thing means graphically. And so what it means graphically is the following, that if I start with, so I'm always going to note the I spin is in the middle. And so here is I plus 1, here is I minus 1. So I start in this state. Then, using this flip rate, the probability of flipping where one spin is in an unhappy state and flips to being happy, this happens at the rate which is 1/2 1 plus gamma. And again, you can just verify that if SIs are both plus 1, and if these two guys are both plus 1 and this is minus 1, this conspires to give me 1 plus gamma, and then there's 1/2 sitting out in front. Now, there's another interpretation of the same picture, which is the following, which is that as I mentioned at the end of yesterday's lecture, whenever you have two misaligned spins, imagine putting a domain wall particle. These are the elementary excitations of the spin system. So at the end of the process, what's happened is these two domain wall particles have annihilated each other. So this is also the same as annihilation. And this particle representation of the domain walls turns out to be extremely useful for developing intuition. On the other hand, if I have a state that looks, say, plus and minus, the two flanking spins are oppositely oriented, and then say this is plus, then we know that this will now go, so here's my outside environment, so this guy will flip, and according to this rate, if these two guys are oppositely oriented, this is zero, and I just get a rate which is 1/2. And in terms of the domain wall picture, what's happened is this domain wall particle has just hopped by one point step to the left. And then there's similarly, I could have done it the other way around. I could have had up, down, down, in which case my domain wall was over here. And then at the end of this flip, this guy goes up, and the domain wall particle is hopped here. So these two events just correspond to free diffusion of a domain wall with a rate 1/2. And finally, if I start in the happy state and make it unhappy by flipping the middle spin, as we saw last time, the rate of this is 1/2 1 minus gamma. And this corresponds to pair creation. So I start with no domain walls, and at the end of the process, I have two domain walls, so I have creation. And since domain wall particles are a measure of the energy in the system, then as domains are created, you increase the energy. As domains are annihilated, you decrease the energy. And if I'm living at zero temperature, and remember that here gamma was equal to hyperbolic tanh of 2 beta j. So at zero temperature, gamma is equal to 1. This doesn't exist, and so there's no possibility of creation. So what's happening in one dimension is that you have a gas of domain wall particles in some arbitrary initial state, and these particles diffuse freely. Whenever they come together, they can annihilate. And so there's a one-to-one mapping between the evolution of the spin system and an annihilation process in one dimension. So it's a very handy way of remembering what's going on. OK, so let me build on this now. And let me just remind you of a couple of things from last time. So we found, first of all, an equation for S. So I'm calling capital Sj is the thermal average of little sj. And we had an equation, Sj dot was equal to minus twice thermal average of Wj Sj. And so this equation expresses in a very succinct way how the average spin at the J site changes. If you pick the J spin, which happen, and the probability that it's flipped is proportional to the rate of flipping, which is just the flip rate at the J spin. And if the spin flips, the amount that the spin changes is twice its value with a minus sign. So that's why this is minus 2 Sj for the change in the spin value. And the delta t that appears, you know, this is ds by dt. So ds is minus 2 Sj. And dt is 1 over Wj. And so that's where we get this equation. Now, there's already one thing. And so what we did last time is we worked this out, and we got the equation, which is minus Sj plus gamma over 2, Sj minus 1 plus Sj plus 1. Now, already at this stage is something extremely important to emphasize, which is notice that Wj, if we go back to the formula here, is quadratic in the spins. So in principle, here is an operator which is linear in the spin. Here I have linear in the spin, something which is quadratic in the spin. So the whole product here should be up to third order in spin. So if there wasn't some miracle cancellation going on, we have an equation where a one-body operator involves a three-body operator. And such a structure of an equation is called a hierarchical equation, because if I have a one-body function that then involves, on the right-hand side, a three-body function, that means that I've got to solve for a three-body function. But if we put three body on the left-hand side, there'll still be a W appearing on the right-hand side, so I'll get five body operators, and I'll get an infinite hierarchy of equations. This is one of the fundamental problems in many body physics, is that oftentimes equations for correlation functions have this hierarchical structure where end body involves higher body, and there's no way to solve them. And what people normally do when you're confronted with this hierarchy is that you can truncate the hierarchy in some way. You know, there's the Hartree-Fock approximation, there's the mean field approximation, there's a random phase approximation. Maybe some of you have heard of these terminologies in other courses, but the point is that these hierarchies, there is no good way of solving them, and one has to resort to some kind of an approximation, which ultimately boils down to a mean field type theory, where you say that a product of n-body correlation functions, and where an n-body correlation function is written as a product of lower order correlation functions. And what you choose to do, this breaking of the hierarchy, is what gives you the different types of approximations. But they're all uncontrolled, and they all end up giving you mean field results in the end. Here for the Ising model, there's a miracle that happens because of the fact that the form of the WJ is sufficiently simple that even though it's in principle three-body, there's a cancellation because an SI squared appears, and the SI squared is 1. And so it lowers the order, and so you get closed equations for these correlation functions. And that's why, in fact, the one-dimensional Ising model is soluble. So now what we wrote down yesterday, and in fact I wrote down an error, so let me correct my error from yesterday. So Sj of t, the solution to this thing is, it's equal to ij of gamma t times e to the minus t. I think I had two somewhere floating around. So this is the solution for Sj at t equals 0 is equal to delta J0. So what I mean by this is that the spin at the origin is chosen to be plus 1. All other spins have zero mean value, so they're equally likely plus or minus. And then this is going to be the value of the spin at the J site of the lattice given this initial condition. For a general initial condition, then you know you can think of this because this is a linear problem now, because the equation of motion is linear. If I have a source at the origin, it gives rise to this response at site J. So if I have a source at some other site of the lattice, in more general initial condition, the way we can generalize this is just write this as I j minus m of gamma t e to the minus t times s m of t equals 0, summation over all m. And this would be the generalization of this formula for an arbitrary initial condition. So for general initial condition. Now, from this exact solution, from this equation of motion, another thing that we learned from last time is that if I sum this thing up over all j, so I take this equation, sj dot, and sum, you know, over all j, and in this case, it's simplest to think of doing this on a periodic ring, so we just go around the circle, then on the left-hand side, we just sum up the spins at every site, and if I divide by 1 over the total number of spins in the system, the left-hand side is just m dot. Here I have minus m, and here I have plus gamma times m. So we get an equation, m dot is equal to minus 1 minus gamma m, whose solution is m of t is equal to e to the minus 1 minus gamma t. So what it tells us is that at finite temperature, the system will settle down to a finite state in which the magnetization is zero. My initial state, if I had non-zero magnetization, whatever it happens to be, I'll always end up with zero magnetization. And it's only at zero temperature that the magnetization is conserved. So it says here that the solution is that m of t goes to zero for positive temperature, and m of t is conserved for t equals 0. Now, this last statement is one of these dichotomies of these spin systems, because you might say that how can the magnetization be conserved? If I go to zero temperature, the system should go to a ferromagnetic ground state. So how could the magnetization be conserved? And it's the same as this martingale thing that I mentioned to you on the first or second lecture, which is that it is the case that in the long time limit on a finite ring, the system will go to the ferromagnetic ground state. But if, for example, I start with 2/3 of the spins initially up and 1/3 down, then 2/3 of the time I'll end up in the spin-up state, and 1/3 of the time I'll end up in the spin-down state. So I'm always guaranteed to have the magnetization conserved, even though the final state is perfectly ferromagnetic. It's just the probability of these different states depends on the initial condition. Yes?
Can we look at it in a way where we have domain walls and anti-domain walls, and these rules there?
Well, so when you said anti-domain walls, what do you mean by anti-domain walls?
In the sense that, you know, going from left to right, you have a domain. If I assign plus sign to the one on the left.
Okay.
And so think of these as kinks.
Mm-hmm. And anti-kinks. Yeah, sure.
And the conservation of the magnetization.
Right.
I think.
Well, what I'd say is that if the external magnetic field is zero, then kinks and anti-kinks are in all respects identical, so there's no reason to distinguish between them. However, if we turn on a finite external magnetic field, then you know, kinks want to move in an overall direction, and then there is maybe some distinction between this thing. But I don't think that in this particular instance, excuse me, for this simple type of, you know, two-component order parameter that you need to worry about the distinction between kinks and anti-kinks. Okay, so let me now turn to the correlation function, because as we see from this result, the magnetization just goes to zero for finite temperature, and at zero temperature, the magnetization is conserved. So we don't get any dynamical information for how the system goes to the ordered state. So let's now look at what I called Sij, which is defined to be the mean value of Si, Sj. And this two-spin correlation function will be decisive in determining the approach to how the system approaches its final state. So now let's write down the equation for Sij dot. And in the same fashion as over here, how will this correlation function change? If we pick any other spin except ij, nothing changes. So we have to pick either spin I or spin j and flip it. And when we flip either spin I or spin j, this correlation function will change by minus twice its value. Because if I have both spins up, the spin correlation function is 1. I flip one of the spins, it changes to minus 1. So the change has been from plus 1 to minus 1. It changed by minus 2. And vice versa. If the two spins are anti-aligned, and I change one flip one of them up, then I start with an initial correlation function minus 1. It goes to plus 1. So the change is, again, minus twice the correlation function. So this is nothing more than minus twice. And then I have Si, Sj times Wi plus Wj. So this is the total rate at which I flip either spin I or spin j. And so let's now analyze this. And again, once you get into the game, it's kind of a pleasant game of reducing this to a closed equation. But again, let me point out that this, in principle, is a two-body operator. Here are two-body operators inside of the flip rate. So this is, in principle, a four-body operator. And so it looks like we're developing an equation hierarchy. But again, because of the magic of the Ising variables, it all goes away, and we end up with a closed equation. So we get minus 2 Si, Sj. And then I have, so what's Wi? So let me write this as 1 half 1 minus gamma over 2 Si, Si minus 1 plus Si plus 1. So that's Wi. And then I have plus 1 half 1 minus gamma over 2 Sj times Sj minus 1 plus Sj plus 1. And that's the last bracket. So let's first of all look at the 1 half term. So I have Si, Sj times 1. Si, Sj times 1, there's a factor of a half, so they add up to 1. And then I have minus 2 here, so the leading term is just minus 2 Sij. So that's dealing with this term and that term. Now let's look at the terms which involve gamma. So first of all, there's a 1 half, 1 half, and a 2. So there's an overall factor of 1 half. And the minus cancel. So I get a gamma over 2 sitting out in front. And now let's look at this guy, Si, Sj, when it operates with this. So the Si and the Si annihilate each other. And then I have Sj, Si minus 1. So let me write this as Si minus 1 Sj. And this is, let me make it more clear that it's little s. Si minus 1 Sj. And then I have a term, this guy comes over with this one. And again, the SI cancels, and I have SJ with SI plus 1. So I have plus SI plus 1 SJ. And then from this term, I have the same story, except now it's the SJ which annihilates. I'm going to get SI SJ minus 1. So let's keep the bracket open, plus SI SJ minus 1 plus SI SJ plus 1. Plus 1. And then all of this is inside of the thermal average. And here's a little pictorial representation of what's happening here. Here was site I, here was site J. And basically what we did is that we computing the correlation function between I and J, and what we ended up involving was I minus 1 with J, that's this term, I plus 1 with J, that was that term. Then I also have I J minus 1, so there's a term I J minus 1, and a term I J plus 1. And you see that if I'm looking at correlations between two sites with separated distance I minus J apart, that involve correlation functions of distance 1 less and 1 greater. Now, for a translationally invariant system, so, you know, translational invariance, then I expect that S I comma J is some function of absolute value of I minus J only. Right? It should only depend on the separation and not the absolute location. If the spin system is not homogeneous, then all bets are off. But for a homogeneous spin system, we have this. And let me define this thing. So let's call this distance. Let's call this K. Let's all call this as GK. And so from this, we can now write an equation for GK dot, the time derivative. And so we get minus equals minus twice GK, that's this guy here. But now, this term is just I minus 1J, which is a distance which is 1 larger than K. This is a distance which is 1 less than K, 1 less than K, 1 larger than K. And so I'm going to get plus gamma GK minus 1 plus GK plus 1. So there is my equation of motion. Notice, oh, I never wrote it down here. Oh, I did write it down. Notice how similar it is to this equation. It's almost the same, except for an overall factor of 2. So we sort of know how to solve this equation, sort of, but not quite. And I'll tell you the not quite in just a moment. The not quite is the fact that this equation has to be supplemented with a boundary condition. Because over here, all we needed was an initial condition, and then we could solve for everything. But here, there is an important boundary condition because we must have that g of 0 is identically equal to 1. Because what is g of 0? That's equal to the thermal average of si, si. But by definition, si squared is 1, so we must have 1. So to solve this equation, we will build it out of solutions like this. But we also have to enforce the fact that at the origin, this thing must be equal to 1. So in order to do this, it now becomes a little bit technical and not terribly fun. So I might skip some of these non-fun details and just come quickly to the answer. But you know, I'll try and give you a sense of what I'm doing here. So let me keep this solution, because I'll use it momentarily. So let me just say some things about the solution. So first point is that here we have a, you know, there's many different ways you could state what this equation is. It's a partial differential equation. If I really wanted to be kosher here, I should have written dgk by dt. The thing is that here we have differences in space index. And if I go to the continuum limit, this becomes nothing more than a derivatives in space. In fact, this is very close to the discrete Laplacian operator. And so in the continuum limit, it becomes like a Laplacian. So I'm going to get dg by dt is Laplacian of g. So notice that you end up with a diffusion equation. And in fact, one of the dirty secrets of non-equilibrium statistical physics is that one of the only equations that we know how to solve is the diffusion equation. And it's mind-boggling how many many-body problems, when you look at it at the right angle, just becomes a diffusion equation. And once you have the diffusion equation, then you're in business. So that's point number one. Second point is that, what is the most general solution to such an equation? First thing is that you'd ask, well, what is the solution to the homogeneous equation? So homogeneous equation is setting this equal to 0. And this equation is a second order constant coefficient difference equation, which is the same as the constant coefficient second order differential equation, whose solutions are exponential. So there is a homogeneous solution. So G is equal to a homogeneous solution plus a particular solution, which means any solution of the inhomogeneous problem. And if you can guess the inhomogeneous solution by any method possible, then you're in business. OK, so the homogeneous solution is just the equilibrium solution to this equation. And so the thing is that if you assume for the homogeneous solution, because the equation is a constant coefficient second order equation, you should say the solution is an exponential. So if you plug in exponential, so let's try here, homogeneous solution is a to the power k. That's a homogeneous solution. Then you'll find that you get a consistent solution when eta takes a particular value. And that particular value turns out to be hyperbolic tanh beta j to the power k. So that is the homogeneous solution. And you may recognize this, I hope you recognize this, because this is nothing more than the correlation function of the equilibrium Ising model. So have you guys seen this before in any class on Ising models? OK. And then the particular solution is essentially this type of solution. And so I just have to write it as summation over all m, I, j minus m. But now gamma is going to 2 gamma, so I, j minus m, 2 gamma t, e to the minus 2t, times the initial correlation function at t equals 0. So that is, in principle, the general solution. And so if I now provide the right initial condition, then I'm done. And and here comes the part that's ugly and kind of tricky, which is that in order to make the right initial condition, I've got to build something that forces the correlation function at the origin to be 1. And so there's some detailed explanation in my notes, which I find is extremely hard to actually give in a lecture. So I'm going to just say, please read the notes. And let me just not worry about like how to actually choose this initial condition such that you enforce this boundary condition. But it can be done, and it is not that difficult to do. But it's easier to read it, actually, than to hear me try and stumble over it. So excuse me. So at this stage, I just want to write down the answer. And so here's, by the way, this is g sub k. So the answer is gk is equal to tanh beta j to the power k. Oh, OK. So sorry, one more thing which is missing here, which is that there's two parts to this. One is that, you know, given you are free as the user to choose your initial condition. So you know, you like to say, well, this should be arbitrary. But the point is that it's not completely arbitrary because of the fact that one has to enforce this. And this is where this condition makes the choice of this initial condition not quite arbitrary. And that's the part that's ugly. But now let's imagine that we start with the random initial condition. That's probably the simplest random initial condition. So I'm going to assume that each spin is equally likely to be spin up or spin down. So for that random initial condition, the answer to the correlation function is gk. And let me even do one more thing, because I want to make my life as simple as possible. Let me take the random initial condition, and now let me take the zero temperature limit. Why do I want to focus on the zero temperature limit? Because as I mentioned in last lecture, there's supercritical dynamics, critical and subcritical. And the interesting case is subcritical. And in the case of one dimension where the phase transition is at zero temperature, so the interesting case in terms of the evolution of the system is zero temperature dynamics. And again, coming back to this picture, we see that if there's non-zero temperature, there'll be a non-zero creation rate. And so what will happen is that there is these different reactions, diffusion, annihilation, and creation. And they conspire to give me some steady state final density. And so the fact that it goes to a steady state or an equilibrium state is what would be considered non-interesting from the perspective of non-equilibrium statistical physics. But if I'm at zero temperature, the creation rate is zero, and I have this gas of particles which is just continuing to annihilate ad infinitum, and in a finite system, you go to a final dead state where there's no domain walls. But if I'm in the thermodynamic limit, the system will continue to evolve forever, and that's what's considered the interesting limit. So in this interesting limit, where the hyperbolic tangent is 1, so that factor just turns into just a factor of 1, here is the answer. So gk is equal to 1 minus e to the minus 2t times I0 of 2t plus ik of 2t plus summation twice from j equals 1 to k minus 1 of ij of 2t. So these Bessel functions of imaginary argument, they appear over and over again in these random walk-like problems. Okay. So now let me focus on, or let me specialize now to the case where we're going to get some interesting physical information, which is the near-neighbor correlation function. So G1, the near-neighbor correlation function, equal to 1 minus e to the minus 2t. And in that case, this sum goes over no range, and so it just goes away. And I'm just left with I0 of 2t plus I1 of 2t. Now let me remind you that I of t, I n of t, asymptotically goes like e to the t divided by the square root of 2 pi t. And so the dependence of n only appears in higher order terms. But that's roughly speaking what these Bessel functions are doing. So if I now look at the density of domain walls, and remember that I derived this last time, that if I have the near-neighbor correlation function, then we can relate it directly to the density of domain walls by rho is equal to 1 minus g1 over 2. And so this is equal to e to the minus 2t times I0 plus I1 plus I1 over 2. And then the limit of time going to infinity. So this asymptotic limit was the case t going to infinity here. So the limit as t is going to infinity, this thing just goes over into 1 over the square root of 4 pi t. So this is perhaps the main result of this whole story, which is that I'm asking for the density of these elementary excitations by this process of diffusion and annihilation, and they're decaying away at a rate 1 over square root of t. And that's the primary result here of the kinetics of the one-dimensional Ising model with Glauber kinetics, that the system coarsens and coarsens, the density domain walls decays like 1 over square root of t, and eventually the system will reach the ground state in the finite system. Let me just close this little discussion with a kind of 2-minute derivation of the same result. Again, in a lot of these problems in non-equilibrium statistical physics, there's always the hand-waving back of the envelope way and the formal way. And let me just show you what happens with back of the envelope derivation, which is if you think about a gas of particles. So here's my gas of particles. Some of them are close, some of them are far away, and they're diffusing around. And then I wait a time. So this is, say, at t equals 0. If I now wait a time, t, which is of the order of L squared, so let's wait a particular time t, which is greater than 0. So these particles diffuse around. So here is a world line of a particle. Here's another world line. These two particles, maybe they annihilated and they died. Maybe these two particles annihilated and they died. And what I would say is that if at this later time, so I began with some initial separation, say L0 is the initial average initial separation. At some later time, maybe you have some new separation, L of t. Now, what I would argue is that if there was any particles that were closer together than L of t, they would have annihilated because, you know, particles that are close in a time t, what I guess I would like to say here is in a time t, the displacement So actually, I guess what I want to say here is let's consider time t greater than 0, t is of the order of L squared over d, where L is something I'm free to choose. But what I would say is I've weighted time, which is this far, then there is a characteristic separation between particles, which is L of t. And if there are particles which are any closer than L of t, then they'll be like in this configuration, they will have already annihilated. So what I'd like to say is that the density at time t is of the order of 1 over basically L. And so this is going like 1 over the square root of t. So this is a hand-waving argument to essentially verify the result we had over here, that the density of domain walls decays like 1 over square root of t. Yes, Eric.
So the coarsening here means that the domains are getting bigger?
Correct.
Okay, and so they're getting bigger. Right?
Exactly so. Okay. So let me now turn to a higher dimensional case. In higher dimensions, let me now pose the following question for you, which is sort of answered in my notes, but it's just interesting to think about, which is that we see here that in one dimension, if I prepare the system in some arbitrary initial state and suddenly quench to zero temperature, just one second, the system coarsens and coarsens and eventually reaches the ground state. What happens in higher dimensions? Okay, now ask your question. Right. Well, so what happens in higher dimension? So let me pose a question to you now. I prepare a system. Imagine I give you as a simulation homework. Just simulate the Ising model in two dimensions and three dimensions at zero temperature. So I prepare my spins in random orientations, and I then have zero temperature dynamics. And what does zero temperature dynamics mean in higher dimension? So I've got to write down the flip rate in higher dimension. But the result is clear right from the very beginning, is that you can only allow energy lowering moves or energy conserving moves. You can never increase the energy if you're at zero temperature. So the system will evolve by energy lowering moves or energy conserving moves until you can't evolve anymore. And so the question is, what is the final state of the system? So does anybody want to hazard a guess? Someone who maybe read the notes really carefully? Or maybe didn't read the notes at all? What happens? What do you think? What's the simplest possible thing that could happen?
Same thing.
Which means what? What do you mean by same thing?
Same type of coarsening.
Okay. So there it is on page 58, the square root of t coarsening, like the pattern that's coarsening and coarsening. And so you'd like to say that it just coarsens ad infinitum and you reach the ground state? I'm putting words in your mouth, but I'm leading you along a primrose path that's going to lead to a cliff. Okay, so the thing is that I have to say that when I've given like a research seminar on this problem, and I ask faculty people, what do you think happens? The average faculty person gets the answer wrong. So if you get the answer wrong, it's par for the course. If you get the answer right, then you're smarter than the average faculty person. But the point is that in higher than one dimension, the system not necessarily reaches the ground state. And so the answer is that in two dimensions, it appears that one-third of the time you will reach a stripe state, and two-thirds of the time you reach the ground state. So that is that this coarsening picture, which seems so obvious and so compelling, and which on page 58 of the notes, you see it right in front of you. So the answer is that in d equals 2, two-thirds of the time, so probability, two-thirds, you reach the ground state. And one-third of the time, you reach a stripe state. And what do I mean by a stripe state? So think about a very large square lattice, like this. And what I mean by stripe is that, for example, you have plus, minus, plus, minus. That's an example of a stripe state. And the thing is that according to zero temperature Glauber dynamics, you can never raise the energy of the system. And you see that if I think about microscopic spins here, if there's a minus spin here and it flips to plus, then you do a little kink in the domain wall. That increases the length of the interface between plus and minus, but that raises the energy, so it can't happen. So if by bad luck you fell into a stripe state, you stay there forever. So this is known as a metastable state because it's not the ground state, but there are energy barriers to take you out of this metastable state. But at zero temperature, the height of these barriers is infinite. This problem of metastable states that get frozen in is basically what underlies the problem of glasses and spin glasses, where you have, like in window glass over there, the arrangement of atoms is not the crystal lattice, but it's some amorphous state. And if you let this system sit for like hundreds of years, in fact, it'll flow to a lower energy state, trying to find itself into the ground state. But in the case of being exactly at zero temperature, this system is stuck forever. If the temperature was infinitesimal, eventually you would reach the ground state. But at zero temperature, you never do. Yeah?
Do the numbers 2 by 3 and 1 by 3 have some microscopic origin?
Let me write then and be a little bit more careful. Across the equal to. And in fact, we've come up recently with a paper. We actually, it's not 2/3. It's some horrible transcendental number that involves like some mathematical physics functions, and there are zeros of them. So we actually have come up with a prediction that seems to fit with data, but you know, it's not rigorous by any stretch of the imagination. Yes?
So if the domains are really getting coarser and have things like this, how is the magnetization conserved?
Well, the thing is that the magnetization is conserved only in one dimension.
Okay.
So in higher dimensions, the magnetization is not conserved in general for the Ising-Glauber model.
But even in one dimension, let's see, you have half of it up and half of it down or something like that.
Yeah, well, no, in one dimension, the magnetization is conserved.
But if it's half up, half down, then how is that?
Well, you know, again, the point is that, like, suppose I start with a system half up and half down. And suppose it's just a single domain wall. So this single domain wall will diffuse. Well, actually, there'll be two domain walls. Because if I have, like, a finite ring, and say on this side it's all plus, and say on this side it's all minus. So you have a domain wall here and a domain wall here. These two domain walls will diffuse around. And when they meet, they annihilate. And the system will either end up all plus or all minus. Which one does it end up with? And you know, this is very much like the problem of the exit probability of the 1D random walk on the interval, which is that depending on the initial state, you'll either end up with all plus or all minus, and the fraction of times you end up with all plus is equal to the initial magnetization.
Oh, okay, so the magnetization at the end doesn't have to be equal to the original magnetization.
No, it is equal to the mag.
Well, but all plus, how is that?
No, but the thing is that with certain probability it'll be all plus, and with another probability it'll be all minus. So when you average over all realizations of the dynamics, you can't just look at one system. You've got to imagine starting with a particular initial system and then looking at every possible realization of the dynamics. Some realization will end with all plus, some will end with all minus, and the fraction of those two cases of all plus and all minus will be such that the magnetization is conserved.
Okay,
but that only happens in one dimension.
But for a single...
Right, for a single event, it may not happen that way. It's the same as the one-dimensional random walk in the interval. If I start over here with the probability, if this is a length, if this is 0 and this is L, we know that with the probability X over L, we will reach, we'll exit by the right, which is a very small number. But in a particular realization, it could happen at exit by the right. So for that realization, the chance of exiting was 1. But when we average over all realizations, we get the right answer. Anyways, what happens in D equals 3? Well, in fact, let me write a D larger than 2. And it turns out that in this case, ground state is never reached. And I put never in quotes, because what do I mean by the word never? Maybe I should be more like a lawyer and put here like a star. So what do I mean by star? Which means that as L goes to infinity. So if I take a finite system of size 4 by 4 by 4 and let evolve, then some fraction of those states will go to the ground state. If I go to 10 by 10 by 10, a smaller fraction goes to the ground state. If I go to 20 by 20 by 20, an even smaller fraction still. And what I can tell you is that in a 10 by 10 by 10 system, the fraction of states, initial states which reach the ground state, is like 10 to the minus 8. And by 10 to the minus 40, it's like 10 to the minus 20 or something like that. It's amazing how you just never reach the ground state. So I just wanted to point out these things because they're so queer and so mysterious. And so what I'd like to do for the next maybe 15 minutes or so is let me turn to one case in higher dimensions that you can actually solve explicitly. And it's a very beautiful problem that has interesting connections to other branches of physics and mathematics that I hope you'll find amusing. So the problem is that we see that coarsening of a random system is complicated, and the main advances have been only by numerical simulations. And part of the reason why it's so complicated is we have a system of coarsening domains, and all these domain interfaces are interacting with each other. It's a very non-local problem. So I want to consider now the simplest possible case, which is, let's just consider a single interface. So let's look at a single interface evolution. So the simplest possible interface you can imagine is just a straight interface. But that's pretty boring because it can't evolve at zero temperature. So I'm going to do this all at t equals zero, again, to make the system as simple as possible. So a straight interface can't move at all because it's just stuck. So the simplest interface you can have that allows some dynamics is a so-called single corner interface. So let's study this. So I imagine here, I forget in my notes which side is plus and which is minus. Can I just look at my notes for a second? OK, so this is the plus side. So all the spins here are plus, and all the spins here are minus. And let's just ask, what happens when I let the system evolve by zero temperature dynamics? So first of all, it's only a spin at a corner that can evolve. Because again, think about putting this on a square lattice. And here's a minus spin. It has two plus neighbors over here and two minus neighbors over here. So this spin at the corner is in a zero energy environment. And so it can change its state with no cost in energy. Every other spin, like for example here, this guy has got three minus neighbors and one plus neighbor. So it costs energy to flip it. So only spins at the corners can flip. So for example, this spin can flip and turn to a plus, and then the interface looks like this. And now at this stage, here's a spin at a corner. Here's a spin at a corner. This spin is at a corner. So what can happen now is that this interface could flip back. Or, for example, this spin could flip and make the interface larger. And similarly, this spin could have flipped. And you see that we can now erode away this corner interface and make some kind of a curvy interface. And the goal now is to calculate the shape of this interface. And there are two cases to consider. There's a so-called driven interface. And there is the unbiased interface. Unbiased interface. And the reason I'm presenting these problems is because they have such beautiful connections to classic problems in mathematics and physics. So what do I mean by driven interface? What I mean by driven is that whenever a spin flips from minus to plus, it can never flip back again. And the way that you can accomplish this is that you can put on a small magnetic field, H, externally. And what that does is that it makes the flip rate of minus to plus energetically favorable of plus to minus. And so driven interface corresponds to H greater than 0. And so what's going to happen here is that wherever you have a corner which looks like this, then it can erode away. So for example, I continue on. This one I erode away. And then this I erode away. And this I erode away, and so on down the road. And eventually, I build up some kind of a staircase-like interface, whatever it is. And the spins, which are here, 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 and here, are all susceptible to flipping. And eventually, this thing is going to just continue evolving. And I want to ask, what is the asymptotic shape of this interface? The other case of the unbiased interface means that in addition to going this way, the interface can also go back the other way. And the thing which is amazing is both of these problems in the limit of long time go to a limiting shape. And the limiting shape is very simple and very beautiful. And so for H equals 0, which is the unbiased interface, here there is a one-to-one connection between the shape of the unbiased interface and the partitions of the integers. So here you have the integer partitions. How many people have heard the terminology integer partitions? Some of you, none of you, few of you. What is an integer partition? This is one of those things that you could learn in grade school and be impressed by. So an integer partition is, for example, if I have the number 4, I can represent that as 3 plus 1, 2 plus 2, 1 plus 2 plus 1 plus 1, or 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1. It's just all ways it can break up 4 into smaller integer pieces. And the way that you can represent this integer partition is you take the number 4, and I think of it as 3 little boxes plus 1 box, 2 boxes and 2 boxes together, or 2 plus 1 plus 1, or I have 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1. So that's the partitions of 4. And you can start seeing like how I can build up the partitions of any size number. The thing is that this shape is exactly the complement of this interface. In the case of an unbiased interface, there's a one-to-one mapping between each configuration here and the partitions of the integers. And so because of that fact, you can use results about the partitions of the integers to calculate the shape of the interface. So first of all, this problem of the partition of the integers made Ramanujan famous. Have people heard the name Ramanujan? Very famous Indian mathematician who wrote George Hardy and came to Cambridge, England, and became, you know, just fabulously famous. And, you know, he's just, you know, I can't help but tell you some story about this. I mean, I've read his biography, and it's really quite amusing because, you know, he was a self-educated guy. And he wrote a letter to Hardy somewhere like in 1910 or 1912. And, you know, it begins something like, I'm just a humble guy from India, and I'm just a, you know, I'm self-educated, but let me show you some of the things that I've written. And, you know, and so he wrote these theorems, and the way that Hardy described it is that these were so amazing and so beautiful that they had to be true, because if they weren't true, you wouldn't have the imagination to write them down. You know, it's very easy to write fancy schmancy mathematics, and it's wrong. But if you write something which is true, that it has some intrinsic beauty that's so beautiful that, you know, it has to be correct. So the thing is that Hardy had a collaborator named Littlewood, and so you might know there's very famous books by Littlewood and Hardy, and they proved all kinds of interesting things in number theory. Hardy and Littlewood were very good friends, and Littlewood was kind of a shit disturber, and he always used to like to pull off pranks. And so Hardy got this letter, which had all these Indian stamps, and it looked like it was, you know, from India, but he thought, it's Littlewood. He has come up with this. You know, there must be an April Fool's hoax. So, you know, he went to Littlewood and said, well, come on, you know, tell me what you did and all that. And so he said, oh, I didn't do anything. I, you know, this is legit. And so they spent some time looking at it. And then Hardy came to this conclusion that what he wrote was so beautiful that it had to be true and this had to be real. And so that was the start of this collaboration for Ramanujan, who, you know, I mean, he's just amazing. Unfortunately, he died an early death because he came to England. He didn't agree with the English weather and he had tuberculosis. And in fact, when he was dying, I mean, there's this apocryphal, you know, this sort of story, which is that, you know, Ramanujan was so good at number theory, and he's in room 1729 in the hospital, and he was visited by Hardy, and Hardy said, I bet you can't think of anything interesting about the number 1729. He said, oh, of course I can. It's the smallest number that can write as a sum of 2 cubes, 12 cubed plus 1 cubed and 11 cubed plus 10 cubed. So that's... I'm sorry, I got it wrong. It's 9 cubed plus 10 cubed. Anyway, so that was Ramanujan. You know, there's also another important theory and number theory theorem, which is that there's no such thing as a dull number. Everyone know this theorem? Because if there was a proof by contradiction, because if there was a dull number, it'd be either the first in the sequence of dull numbers, and it would be interesting, or it'd be there is no dull numbers. Well, no, sorry. There is no such thing as a dull number, and proof by contradiction. Let's suppose there is a dull number, then there's two possibilities. Either it's unique and it's interesting, or it's the first in the sequence of dull numbers, therefore interesting. Okay, anyways, enough with the entertainment part now. So let's now talk about the driven interface problem. So for the driven interface, the thing here is that here is a one-to-one mapping between something called the asymmetric exclusion process. How many people have heard of this terminology? So the asymmetric exclusion process is probably one of the simplest many-body problems there exists. And so the asymmetric exclusion process, let's go over here and spend a little bit of time discussing it. So the asymmetric exclusion process is a diffusion process on a one-dimensional line where you have lattice sites. And particles can occupy the lattice sites, but there's many particles. And the rules of the game are very simple. All you do is you hop to the right if the nearest neighbor site is empty. So you pick a particle at random, and if its right neighbor is empty, excuse me, it hops. If it's occupied, it doesn't hop. So this is allowed. So this guy would then go over to here. But this hop is not allowed. Nothing would happen then. So this is the asymmetric exclusion process, as simple can be. And it turns out that this problem is so rich, and still everything is not worked out in it. And so if you want to find a problem that has no formalism to define the model, but is just incredibly rich, this is your baby. Anyways, the thing is that there is a very simple way of representing this interface as an asymmetric exclusion process. So let's go over here and just re-examine our interface. This one? Because the right neighbor is occupied. So you're always only going to the right, and you only go to the right if you can step without bumping into somebody. So that's the rules of the game.
Like baseball.
What?
Baseball.
Baseball. Oh, I see. Okay. But there's simultaneous motion. Here this is serial motion. You pick a particle at random. So not quite baseball. Maybe Canadian baseball. I played baseball in Canada, but anyways, I play kind of that kind of baseball. Anyways, so let's go over here. So the thing is that one way we can think about this is flipping of spins. But there's a very useful representation, which is let's take this same interface and just rotate it by 45 degrees. And in this rotated reference frame, then you see you have some kind of interface which maybe looks something like this. There's my rotated reference frame. And the thing is that the evolution of the interface is that whenever there is a little depression here, I can put a particle here, and then this corresponds to like one spin flipping over here. So there's a one-to-one mapping between the deposition of these particles on the little local valleys and the flipping of the spin. So in fact, there's a lot of people who have studied this Ising interface by turning it into a interface evolution problem of deposition and evaporation of particles. In the case of the unbiased interface, this particle could also evaporate, and then we can look at the equilibrium shape of this interface, and that's what many people have done. But I'm going to do something slightly different, which is going to say, I'm going to map this to the asymmetric exclusion process. And so the basic idea in this mapping is that, let me just extend this over here, and so now I have my 45-degree line, which looks something like this. And the rule is that wherever there is a vertical point in the interface, I imagine there is a particle over here. And so here is another particle. Here there is no particle. So I'll try and make it clear which is particle and which is empty. Here there is a vertical part, so there's a particle over here. Here there's a horizontal part, so no particle. Here there's vertical, so particle. And then no particle, and then empty site. And then everything else here is empty, and everything else here is occupied. So the initial state of the system is I start with vertical, horizontal, which means completely occupied and completely empty. So the initial state of the system is this. All particles occupied over here, and all particles empty over here. And now the system evolves by the asymmetric exclusion process. And the point here is that you can verify for yourself now that, for example, that let me find a kosher move. For example, here, this spin could evaporate. And what that would correspond to is that this occupied particle would turn to empty, and this would be occupied. So this is precisely an asymmetric exclusion process move. And so the thing is that the evaporation of the spins or the flipping of a spin corresponds to a particle hopping in the asymmetric exclusion process. So the thing is that we're starting with this step initial condition. We want to ask, how does the step evolve by the asymmetric exclusion process? Now, some of you may have encountered in your undergraduate statistical mechanics class that if I had just pure diffusion, and I start with a step initial condition, that the interface would evolve as an error function. How many people have seen that somewhere? Nowhere. So let me just tell you what the answer is then, which is that you solve the diffusion with a step initial condition. You know that for a point, the solution is a Gaussian. For a step, you have to integrate the Gaussian from minus infinity up to zero, and that's just the error function. And so that's what the solution looks like. It's an error function. And so for pure diffusion, this interface, let me just put it over here just to contrast it. So if I start with a step initial condition, then as time goes on, it does something like this, and something like that, and something like that. And so the width of this interface would grow like the root of t, not a surprise, and you know, there's some exact solution. But now I want to ask what happens over here. What happens over here is really incredibly simple and quite amazing, which is that this interface just does, so we start like, let me make it bigger. And so we start with our step interface, and it does this. At a little later time, it does that. Later time still, it does something like that. Still later, it does something like that. It gradually smooths out, but it smooths out in this perfectly deterministic way in the continuous limit, where I'm looking at the very large distance limit. And the size of this region is scaling like t rather than square root of t. So first thing, in order to solve the single interface problems, we've got to solve this problem of the evolution of a step. Now, in order to solve this evolution, we first have to write down the equation of motion and then solve it. So let me write down the equation of motion for the asymmetric exclusion process. So let me write, let's call n the density of particles. And then dn by dt should evolve by some kind of dynamical equation. And what is that dynamical equation? Well, the thing is that because there's hopping only to the right, you've seen before in convection diffusion and bias diffusion, there should be a term which is proportional to d by dx of some current. And what is that current? And the simplest thing you could possibly write turns out to be the right answer, which is how can there be non-zero current? The only way there can be non-zero current is that if I have an occupied site followed by an empty site. And so the probability of having an occupied site is the density. The probability of having a vacancy is 1 minus the density. And so the simplest thing you might put down here is n times 1 minus n. And then on the right-hand side, you should write something like the second n by the x squared. Why what?
Why do you put that on there?
Well, this is just to account for diffusive fluctuations. So this is called the Burgers equation again. And it appears over and over again in these collective one-dimensional transport problems. But the thing is that whenever you have a bias, typically the bias wins out over diffusion. So we'll forget about diffusion. And that turns out to be correct in the asymptotic limit, that diffusive fluctuations are of order square root of t, whereas the spread is proportional to t. And so then we're stuck with just this equation. So now we might ask, well, how do I solve this equation? So I'm going to set this equal to 0. Now, you saw like maybe sometime in the middle last week, I talked about the method of characteristics to solve this equation. Maybe you got it, maybe you didn't. But I want to solve it simpler than anything fancy here. And let me go back to the very first thing I wrote down on the blackboard on Monday morning, which is let's solve this by scaling. So look at this equation. What kind of scaling does it naturally suggest here? We have n, which is a function of position and time. Shouldn't this be a function of some scale combination of variables? What combination should I use? X over t, why did you say that? Pardon me? I like your first guess better. Why did you do that? Well, notice that downstairs I have a t here and x here. They have to have the same dimension in this framework. I mean, there's like some, you know, I should have probably written a v, d, something like that. But nevertheless, when I write this with a dimensionless velocity, the natural variable is going to be the ratio of x over t. Remember, for the diffusion equation, we had dn by dt is d second by dx squared, and we said the natural variable is x over root t. So here it's x over t. So there it is. So let's just try that, see what happens. So let's plug this assumption into this differential equation, see what happens. So on the left-hand side, we have dn by dt. So when I differentiate this thing with respect to t, I'll have f prime as a function of its argument times the derivative of this guy with respect to t, so times minus x over t squared. And on the right-hand, well, and then I have plus. So this guy, let me write this as n sub x minus, because I have dn by dx, and I have n squared minus 2n nx. And so let's nx. So nx, when I differentiate with respect to x, I'm going to get f prime. And when I differentiate with respect to x, I'll get a 1 over t. So I have, that's nx, so I have 1 minus 2n. And that's, and n is f again, so that's equal to 0. So first of all, so I can write this as f prime, and then I have minus. But now x over t is, say, the scaled variable. So let's call that u. And there's an f prime over t as a common factor. So I have minus u plus 1 minus 2f is equal to 0. What is the solution to this equation? Pretty simple. Either f prime is 0, or f is equal to this. So the two solutions are f prime is equal to 0, or f is equal to 1 minus x over t over 2, which is precisely what we have here. There's a region where the density is 0, and a region where the density is just linear profile, you know, going through 1/2 right at the origin. So here we found, with essentially no work, the solution to the problem. So,
and what about the solution f prime equals 0?
So that's corresponding to this region over here, out here and out here. There the derivative is 0, where the step has not yet propagated. And so the solution is a composite of the flat part and the interfacial region. OK. So now we need one more thing, which is that what we've now found is the particle density on this 45-degree rotated line. And we've now got to somehow relate it to the shape of the interface. And what is the relation is that let's now think not in a discrete picture, but let's go to the continuum limit, where this interface is going to have some kind of a limiting shape, which we're going to try and figure out. And so here we have a curve, y as a function of x, that we'd like to figure out its shape. And one other thing to notice here is let me now call the distance along this rotated line as the z-axis. And notice that there is a one-to-one mapping that a point on the xy plane here corresponds to a unique point along the z-axis. And the connection is z is equal to, let's see, so when y is, so it's equal to x minus y. So for example, when x equals y equals 0, that's the origin of the system. So when x and y are both 0, it's the origin. If I stay anywhere along the 45-degree line, I'm still at the origin in the z-axis. As x gets larger, z gets larger. As y gets larger, z gets more negative. So here is a connection between the coordinates in the xy plane and the coordinates along the z-axis. And then the last part, which then gives a solution to the problem with you know, more or less directly, is that we have to now connect the slope of the interface. When the slope changes, so we start with a particular value of the slope. Here it's infinite slope. If the slope gets smaller, there's a particle there. Wherever there's a horizontal, wherever there is a particle, sorry, this is the crucial equation, and I got myself lost here. So I guess I want to write whenever the slope, I want to write minus y prime is equal to n. So whenever the slope changes, there is a particle. So the slope starts off infinite, and that was all particles. Whenever the slope changes, there is a hole, 1 minus n. So the change in the slope, when it gets smaller, there's...
If you rotate it, anytime there's a particle, there's still plus 1 or minus 1, right? If you use the rotation...
Okay, if I use the rotation, right?
So if you tilt your head, then your slope's always just plus 1 or minus 1. So y prime should be just minus n.
Okay. Y prime is minus n. Thank you for saving me. Incredibly simple equation. Anyways, so the point is that now we can find y as a function of x. So that's equal to the integral of n with a minus sign, n which depends on z dz. And the thing is, we just found n as a function of z. So here I should have really written, in all of this, I had my horizontal coordinate x, but I should have written z. So I just have to integrate this function minus. And so here it's 1 minus z over t dz. This is y of x. And so the thing is that here we have the z coordinate, but z is related to x and y by this. And at this stage, one has to do some little bit of homework. I mean, it's really quite trivial, and I just don't want to do it on the blackboard, because it's just the kind of thing I can't ever get straight. But the result of all of this is at the end of this process, one gets a very amazing equation for the shape of the interface. Square root of x plus square root of y is equal to the square root of t. That's the final result. It's just as amazingly simple can be. By the way, to contrast it to the partition problem, so let me just put the answer for the partition problem. The answer for the partition problem is e to the minus x plus e to the minus y is equal to 1. We're in the, let me call this maybe x bar and y bar. We're here, x bar is equal to square root of pi over 6 x over t, and y bar is equal to square root of pi over 6 y over t. So there's a very different shape for the integer partitions as this single Ising interface problem. How am I doing on time? Am I at the end, or do I have...
Five more
minutes. Okay. Let me just spend. Maybe this is going to take 15 minutes, so I'll spend 5 minutes today and 10 minutes tomorrow. I want to now change gears somewhat and talk about another type of dynamics, because so far we've been talking only about Glauber dynamics, which is single spin flip. But thing is that in the early days of trying to understand the evolution of spin systems, people realized that alloys cannot be described. People try to use the Ising model to describe alloys, because if you think of a binary alloy, say it's made up of copper and tin. Now, is that brass or bronze? I don't remember which is which. I'll look it up in Wikipedia. But anyways, if you think about a two-component alloy, you have two components. And the spins can, the molecules or the atoms can exchange their position. And if I try to represent copper as, say, spin up and tin as spin down, then it's clear that if I want to try and represent it as a spin process, I can't have copper turning to tin. That would be alchemy, which even Newton couldn't do. So what we need then for so-called spin exchange dynamics is a process where we conserve the magnetization event by event. So I want to spend some time discussing the so-called spin exchange dynamics, where a pair of spins, say like this, can evolve and go up and down. So this spin exchange process is a new type of dynamics that was invented by Kawasaki, I guess, in the 50s or 60s, And it was meant to describe the evolution of an alloy system, where you maybe take an alloy and you suddenly change its temperature and it's well mixed, and then it starts demixing, and you want to understand that demixing process in the framework of a spin model. And so you represent one type of the alloy, or one component to spin up, the other component to spin down. And then you ask, how can the system evolve? And because of the fact that you can't undergo alchemy, then you're forced to invent dynamics which conserves the magnetization explicitly. And so I want to now discuss very briefly the so-called Kawasaki spin exchange dynamics. And so I'm going to just close with an analog of the picture we have here, because I want to represent this in one dimension, because one dimension is already rich enough to show its the fundamental difference between conserved order parameter dynamics and non-conserved dynamics. So let's just look at what happens in spin exchange dynamics in one dimension. And I want to be able to write down the spin flip rate. So the first thing is that here we have a process where instead of looking at a single spin, we have to look at two spins. So if I want to study how a pair of spins evolves, then I have to look at what happens to the local environment as well. So for example, if the two neighboring spins are both spin up, so here we have a domain wall. Here we have a domain wall. And after the end of this process, the environment is still both spin up, but here we have the two spins have exchanged. And what has happened in terms of the domain wall? Well, this domain wall has moved over here, this one has moved over here, and this one has not moved. So what we see is that very much as in the case of this process where a single domain wall would hop freely, here we have two domain walls, which is a measure of how much energy is in the system. And at the end of the process, these two domain walls have just hopped rigidly one step to the left. So this is pair diffusion. And this conserves the energy of the system. So we have pair diffusion. And then we could have done the same thing with both spins on the periphery being down. If I had this situation, then I would have a domain wall here, a domain wall here, and at the end of the flip, down, down, and then this goes to down, up. And so my domain walls have hopped one step to the right. So now let's look when the two domain walls are opposite, the two periphery spins are oppositely oriented, and these guys are up and down again. So in this case, there's a single domain wall here. And what happens now? At the end of the flip, I have plus and minus at the periphery, and here I have minus and plus. And we have three domain walls. So here we have creation. But it's a strange type of creation because it's triplet creation. One gives rise to three. There is a domain wall particle here. So triplet creation. And finally, there is the opposite orientation. So I'll have down and up in the periphery. And I start with left is up, right is down. And then I see what happens when I flip it. So the periphery is down and up. And at the end of this, I have down and up. And in this case, we started with domain walls here, here, and here. All three spins, all three bonds are unhappy. And at the end of the process, only the middle spin, the middle bond is unhappy. And so this was triplet annihilation. Excuse me. So what you see here is that there's a very much an analog of what happened here in the Ising system, in the Ising-Glauber model, except now that single domains, they can give triplet creation. You can have triplet annihilation. And it's pairs of domain walls that hop freely. Because it's pairs of domain walls that hop freely, it turns out that the dynamics of this process is completely different than the Glauber model. And so let me just tell you the punchline, which I'll mention in the first few minutes of next lecture, which is that in the case of the Ising-Glauber model, we found a characteristic length scale, L of t, which scaled as t to the power 1/2. In the case of the Kawasaki dynamics, there's an L of t, which scales as t to the power 1/3. And between 20 and 30 years ago, this question of what was the dynamical exponent for the Kawasaki model was an issue of intense debate, and there still does not exist a clear and simple microscopic derivation of this in general. In one dimension, as I'm going to show, one can derive this in a very simple way, but this contrast between coarsening exponent 1/2 and coarsening exponent 1/3 is one of the fundamental results in the theory of phase ordering kinetics, and it's played a central role in our development of the understanding of non-equilibrium spin systems. So that's where I'll pick up next time. Question, yes?
As we see, is it double creation or triple creation of the new world? Because initially we had one, the new world, and now we have three.
And we started with one, and now we have three.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you just created two?
No. What did I say? Did I say two?
You said triplet creation. That's why it's saying you're only creating two domain worlds.
I see. Okay. Okay, yeah, I mean, maybe my, yeah, maybe, okay, yeah, I see. So maybe I'm, all right, very good point. So maybe I should call this doublet creation and doublet annihilation. But the thing is that it's sort of a catalytic process because you can't create a doublet from the vacuum. You need another particle there to create it. So that's why I was using the word triplet. Maybe a better way of saying it would have been catalytic doublet creation and catalytic doublet annihilation.
Okay, much time.